From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, truth, lies, disinformation. After Russia's recent nuclear explosion, Chernobyl is looking eerily relevant. Then, a new Mexican film by Isa Lopez about children orphaned by drug violence has magical realism, horror, and even humor, making it difficult to get an American release.
Because it's very hard to sell chocolate that is also sardines, but also bacon, you know?
And the Rolling Stones are playing here this week. We'll remember their first gig in Southern California 55 years ago. All that coming up on The Frame. Tell me if you've heard this story before. There's a nuclear accident in Russia, then a spike in radiation, followed by shifting reports of fatalities. It sounds a lot like the 1986 Chernobyl accident, but it's also pretty much what's happening in Russia right now. Russia's dedication to disinformation was a central conceit of HBO's Chernobyl. And in light of the recent Russian accident, we found ourselves thinking about our conversation with Chernobyl creator Craig Mason from earlier this year.
For me, the entire Chernobyl process began with stumbling over a simple fact. Because I was just reading an article about it, and we all know it exploded. And I always like to say, if you walk through the offices here and you ask people, why did the Titanic sink? Every single person will say iceberg. Everyone. No one knows how Chernobyl blew up, essentially. They know it blew up, but they don't know how. And when I was starting just to fill in that small gap of knowledge, the fact that I stumbled over was that on the night of the accident, they were running a safety test. And that is the kind of thing as a writer.
That's gold.
You know, it's gold because the irony is already baked in. What I didn't expect was that those kinds of things would keep coming. And there are so many of them, and I just felt compelled to share them with everybody.
There are details in the telling of this story that are one thing, and then there's the overarching idea about how those details are discussed or not discussed. And I'm going to quote from something that comes later in the series. Every lie we tell incurs a debt to the truth. Sooner or later, that debt is paid.
Yeah.
And that seems to be almost the organizing principle of the series. Yes, there was a meltdown. Yes, there was this accident, but it's about truth and lies.
Without a doubt. Because this is not intended to be a disaster film. Disaster films are exercises in adrenaline, and in the end, the hero wins and nature is defeated. Romance survives the sinking of a ship and so on and so forth. This is not that. Nor is this a polemic against nuclear power. I happen to be in favor of nuclear power, more in favor now of nuclear power, now that I know how hard it is to make a nuclear reactor explode. But it is about this very human thing, not a Soviet thing, human thing. As humans, we struggle with difficult truths, and we are so primed neurologically to take in narrative, and it's being used against us. And listen, without getting too deep into the weeds, I was writing these scripts in 2016.
So how does Chernobyl fit into what I think we can probably agree is a post-factual world?
Well, it is a warning. And it's not just a warning on its own, but the fact that we also then did this other podcast to say, listen, we ourselves, look, I made this show. And now I'm going to tell you some of the things in the show aren't true. But let me tell you why. Let me explain why we had to do it that way. And let me tell you what is real. Essentially, let me promote a culture of truth so that you can see that truth does not undermine the experience of drama. But I do hope that people look at Chernobyl and say, well, we have a choice. We can either live in the moment before or we are forced to live in the moment after. And right now we are in the moment before, but it's getting close.
We're talking with Craig Mason, the writer and creator of the HBO miniseries Chernobyl. I want to play some audio from the first episode. It's one of the only things in the entire series that's not in English, and it's the Russian equivalent of a 911 call to the firefighters. You focus on a number of people, like firefighters. How do you figure out the people that you want to nominate to have active roles as protagonists in the story, and what kind of truth you have and how much fiction you bring to their lives.
I wanted to show this tragedy from many different altitudes, because the nature of the tragedy at the highest level, say in the Kremlin, is disturbing and distressing and upsetting, but it's an entirely different experience on the ground when you're just trying to keep your husband alive. And yet both things are absolutely true about Chernobyl. This is kind of part of the exercise, is there are many aspects to the truth. It is not simple. You can't nail it down. And I wanted people to see it from all those levels so that they could feel how this permeated everything in the Soviet Union.
There are some difficult moments to watch in this series. There are victims of radiation who are essentially melting in hospital rooms. And then there's this scene where some soldiers are sent into a town, I think they're called liquidators.
That's right.
To kill basically every living thing, including the dogs. They're taking aim and killing dogs. And I'm curious about that scene. I mean, is it true? Is that what happened? And why is something like that so important cinematically to put in a story?
So it is true. And there were quite a few men that had to do that job. It wasn't just three guys. There was a lot of liquidators who were essentially ordered to go around the countryside and kill these animals because they were contaminated and there was a fear of contamination. Why is it important? So at some point, Chernobyl ceases to be an accident or a disaster or a fire, and it becomes a war where hundreds of thousands of men are sent to fight an enemy they cannot see. And in war, tragedies are visited upon men not simply because they themselves are wounded or hurt, but because they have to wound and they have to hurt. That is a scar that does not leave most of these men. And I wanted to show that it's not just radiation that gets you. Chernobyl, it has essentially created a new war for all of these men, whose names and whose fates have not been recorded.
Craig Mazin is the creator of the HBO series Chernobyl. It's currently in the running for 19 Emmys. Coming up next on The Frame, Mexico's drug wars have left countless children orphaned. A new movie imagines they're fighting back against the cartels. Isa Lopez has written fiction in her native Mexico, as well as directed children's TV and soap operas. Given her background, it's no surprise that her new film, Tigers Are Not Afraid, has a little bit of everything. It's a dark fairy tale about children whose parents are killed in drug-related violence in Mexico. While the movie has played at horror film festivals, Lopez doesn't define it that narrowly.
I don't believe in genres anymore. I think that the most interesting movies are the ones that use elements of one genre or the other to tell the story that they are trying to convey. And that is a nightmare for distributors, because it's very hard to sell chocolate that is also sardines, but also bacon, you know? And I get it. I understand. But I feel that in this time of absolute saturation of content, we are so used to swap, you know, in a streaming between comedy and horror and genres, and it feels good. And we started sending the movie to all the big festivals in this continent, and it was rejected one after the other. And it was heartbreaking. And I was very close to giving up. And then reconsidered, because it is a genre movie. It is a ghost story. It is a fantasy. And I went for the fantastic and genre circuit of festivals, and they loved it.
Yeah, so once you start appealing to kind of sci-fi genre crowds, they get it, even though it is really a movie that's grounded in reality. And I want to ask you about that reality, about these orphans who could exist pretty much anywhere around the world. These are children who've been orphaned by the drug wars. It feels like it starts almost as a nonfiction film.
Completely. The absolute intention of the movie was that it felt like a documentary, like a war documentary, because it is a war. And in the midst of this extreme reality feeling, the elements of fantasy and horror and the supernatural would be completely integrated, and so would feel a lot more real than they usually feel in genre movies. And then to tap into magical realism and ghost stories.
The title of this film in English is Tigers Are Not Afraid, and you could say that it really applies to this gang of orphan children. The Spanish title is Vuelven, which means they come back. How would you describe that translation? Because they're very different titles from Spanish to English.
Distribution. The title should always have been Tigers Are Not Afraid. And the movie should have been named Los Tigres No Tienen Miedo in Spanish. But it is a tricky movie to distribute because it is a horror, it is a fantasy, but it is also this political expose and this drama. So the distributors were wary of going into the drama side of it and the reality side of it and wanted to stick to the horror elements. And they felt that Tigers Are Not Afraid was not scary enough. And I shyly suggested, well, when they return, which could be assumed to be about the ghosts. And they went with it.
I want to ask you about the setting for the story. It's set in Juarez. How much of the setting feels particularly timely, given what happened not too far from Juarez in El Paso? And why is that city in some ways representative, not just of what's going on in Mexico, but what's going on around the world?
Well, first off, it's not Juarez. It's interesting that you said that, because in the first draft, it was Juarez. But by the time that span between me writing the script and the movie being shot, the extreme violence that that was very characteristic about Juarez had extended to many, if not most, Mexican cities. So we decided to go with a Mexican city. The feeling of the nearness of the border and the violence that is natural now, sadly, of these places is so timely right now, because when we shot the movie and when we released it, we didn't have this pretty much concentration camps along the border to contain the children that are fleeing from the situation that the movie is describing, and the parents that are trying to move their children and keep them safe from this very situation. So the movie becomes ever so more pertinent and part of the conversation that we need to be having.
We're talking with Isa Lopez, the writer and director of the film Tigers Are Not Afraid. There are different elements to the story, but I want to focus on one thing initially, and that is children who lose their parents at a young age.
Mom, ¿dónde estás? Tengo hambre. Háblame, porfa.
Why was that story important to you personally? And how much of this film do you think is about grief?
Well, I did lose my mother when I was 8 years old.
How old was she?
My mother was 46. And it was, of course, it was not in the horrendous situation that the characters in the movie go through. That said, the feeling of getting home and not finding your mother there and never having a chance to say goodbye. And then the feeling that her ghost is walking behind you is very personal.
Mama?
Weirdly enough, I didn't see it when I wrote the script. I thought it was not about me. Not until very late in treatments, a dear friend of mine came and said, "You do know this is your own story." And I didn't. But it's funny how we treat our own trauma in art. And it was a great opportunity to talk about personal pain, but also about the pain that my country is going through, which is also personal, you know? And I think making peace with saying goodbye from your death, which is what Mexico in the end is about. We've always rejoiced in the concept that our death walk with us.
You are telling a story about children that are surrounded by violence. They have lost their parents to violence. They are being hunted by drug gangs. And they're also dealing with grief. So when you were thinking about working with your actors in telling such a harrowing story, even though this is fiction, they have to obviously behave as if it's real. How do you make sure that what you're doing with them is safe?
You know, I'm not a parent. in part because I've always shied away from the responsibility of taking care of someone else's emotions. And suddenly I'm surrounded by these five children, and I created this event that is going to forever mark them. And it can be a beautiful experience that they will remember fondly for the rest of their lives, or I could be scaring them seriously. And I had to improvise to work with them to create that line that happens when you say cut. And it was challenging. It is challenging for a professional actor to understand that division. And for untrained children, even more so. But children know deeply and intimately the how to play a game and how to inhabit fiction and then jump out of it. So I had to connect with that part of them.
This is a film that involves some magical realism. It involves some violence. It involves some danger. It involves some grief. But these kids are also kind of funny. So I want to play a scene early in the film. One of the children is snatched, and the two of the boys are talking with the lead character, Estrella, about what they think happens when children are kidnapped.
Los agarran, se los llevan al chino. El chino los hace trocitos. Venden sus partes.
Son narcos satánicos, tienen pacto con el diablo y hacen hasta misas rojas.
Son negras.
Rojas o negras.
The kids say that Chino, who is the narco boss in the film, chops up kids and sells their parts, and that he and his gang are satanic narcos, and they've made this deal with the devil. But because they're kids, they start squabbling over the correct words. So how did you manage humor, and how does this movie play to audiences depending on their sense of humor? Do some people laugh and some people don't think it's that funny?
Completely. First of all, I can't avoid, even in the darkest situations, going into a little bit of humor, because it is, my nature, my personal nature, but it's also deeply ingrained into being in what it is being Mexican. The darkest experiences are tinted by a magical view and by humor. And that happens in societies that know intimately conflict. And it's funny because the emotional moments in the movie, across the world, people connect. But the few comedic moments, and there are comedic moments, people laugh out loud very, very loudly in places like Belfast, in Ireland.
Because of the Troubles, you think?
Yes, I think because there is a deeply understanding that in the middle of tragedy, you laugh. And in places like Amsterdam, not so much. They love the movie, but nobody laughed in those little moments. And when I asked them about it, what they said is, you know, they understand the concept of comedy, but laughing felt wrong because they're not used to this violence in the open. You know, so it depends on the culture.
Isa Lopez is the writer and director of the film Tigers Are Not Afraid, or Vuelven in Spanish. Isa, thanks so much for coming.
So happy. Thank you, John.
Tigers Are Not Afraid is out in theaters on August 21st and will be available soon on the streaming platform Shudder. Coming up, the Rolling Stones are back in town, not far from where it all began for them in the United States. The Rolling Stones are playing at the Rose Bowl this Thursday, and who knows if it'll be the band's final concert here, but we can tell you about their first ever appearance in the United States. It was in San Bernardino, of all places, way back in 1964. Former KPCC producer Kevin Ferguson has the story about that eventful show.
It's spring, 1964. At the time, San Bernardino basically had one place for rock shows, the Swing Auditorium on E Street, a 6,000-capacity dance hall that, before the Stones, hosted Bob Hope, Jack Benny, all pretty tame stuff, until Bob Lewis came around.
Bob Lewis. I'm retired. I'm a retired concert promoter.
Bob had set up dozens of rock and roll shows in the Inland Empire already, but that spring he was approached by a couple investors looking to put on a concert on Friday, June 5th, at the Swing.
And of course they wanted the Beatles.
Which wasn't as crazy as an idea back then as it seems now. He He made a few calls to New York, but alas, no dice. The Beatles were booked, and he hung up. But word got around, and about an hour later, he got a call from Kevin Eggers, another talent agent who heard Lewis was looking to book a British band.
He said, I've got an act coming to the States called the Rolling Stones. Never heard of them. Never heard of the Rolling Stones. So I called the radio station, KMN, the general manager, and I said, Jerry, I've got an act coming in. I want to see what you think, because I'd have to have their sponsorship. So he repeated over the phone, Rolling Stones, and his program director was walking by his office, and he said, the Rolling Stones, he said, they're really hot.
The show was booked, and the Stones were on their way to make their U.S. debut in San Bernardino, a city more famous today for its messy finances than its contribution to the arts.
I want you back.
At the time, the Rolling Stones weren't nearly as famous as they are now. They'd had a couple hit singles in the UK, all of them covers except for one original, a sunny and acoustic pop tune called Tell Me.
Tell me you're coming back to me, you gotta tell me you're coming.
Despite all that, they still had a few loyal fans in the States. After all, this was the British invasion. Laurie Gastineau is a retired high school English teacher, but in 1964, she was just a high school student, only 15 years old back then, and living in nearby Colton. For Laurie and her friends, this was the highlight of their month.
Well, they were an up-and-coming band. We, of course, listened to the Beatles, and then we started listening to all of the groups that came from England. We loved the beat, we loved the lyrics, and with the Stones, it was a new take on some old classics from blues and such.
And she can't slow walking the dog.
The band had just arrived in the States a few days earlier, performing on Dean Martin's Hollywood Palace show. He wasn't impressed. The only thing rolling were Dean Martin's eyes.
Rolling Stones, aren't they great? We'll have a short intermission, and we'll be back in Hollywood Palace in about a minute. Now, don't go away. You wouldn't leave me here alone with the Rolling Stones.
That Friday, the band arrived in San Bernardino.
And they got in around 5 o'clock. They did a very brief sound check, very basic, you know, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they just stayed in the dressing room until they were ready to go on.
Laurie Gastineau and her friend started lining up at the swing not long after the Stones sound check.
When the doors opened, we all made our mad rush toward the stage.
The audience was 4,000 strong and largely made up of teenage girls, not much older than Laurie. After hours of waiting, around 9:30, the Rolling Stones walked on stage. They opened with a Buddy Holly cover. The room was hot, Mick danced, the girls screamed. Gastineau says the highlight of the night for her and other locals happened about halfway through the band's set.
And of course, the favorite song that they played was Route 66, because San Bernardino was mentioned in that song.
How did the room respond?
Oh, we all knew the lyrics of all the songs, and so we all screamed especially loud when they got to San Bernardino.
The Rolling Stones' 11-song set at the swing lasted just over 20 minutes.
That was their total repertoire. That was it. They didn't rehearse a lot. After a 20-minute set, the show's over, and the Stones did their London exit, which they just dropped their equipment, ran out, and we had a school bus. We didn't have limousines then. We didn't have a budget for limousines. So we put them in a little yellow school bus that we thought would get them in and get them out of town sort of unnoticed, which worked.
The Stones wrapped up that first tour with less than a dozen dates. While they may have been a hit in San Bernardino, the rest of the tour was by all accounts a failure. More awkward TV appearances followed, a couple of state fairs with indifferent audiences. But in 1965, they put out Satisfaction, and that was that. The Rolling Stones would go on to play the Swing Auditorium at least once more. In 1981, the year Start Me Up came out, they planned to come back to the Swing for one more show. That never happened. A plane crashed into the auditorium on September 11th of that year. The damage to the building was so severe, it was never rebuilt. Bob Lewis, the promoter, still keeps a small piece of the stage at his home in Claremont. When I interviewed Laurie Gastineau, we met near the site where the swing once stood. It's a parking lot now. She not only remembers the first Stones show at the Swing, but the second one, that same year. Her future husband, Jim, was in the opening band. She said she was heartbroken to see the Swing go, but happy for the memories.
Knowing that that particular band, the Rolling Stones, is still around today, that's kind of special, knowing that we were at the very first United States concert.
Kevin Ferguson, 89.3 KPCC.
Time is on my side. Yes, it is.
And that's all for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow from the Moen Broadcast Center.
I said you were baby.